This is 89.9 WWNO. Yes, we're headed for another art-filled week. Are you making plans? Or do you need some ideas? Well, you've come to the right place. Whether you're in the mood for a citywide gallery hop, a ballet adaptation of a Tennessee Williams masterpiece, or a look at the upcoming New Orleans Film Festival, it's all in the mixed media. Come along as we go inside the arts. Hi, I'm your host, Diane Mack. It's billed as one of the hottest events of the year for art lovers in and around New Orleans. The Contemporary Arts Center kicks off Art for Art's Sake on Saturday with citywide gallery openings and a big block party. Also, a partnership with the New Orleans Museum of Art, NOMA, brings a unique photographic exhibit to the CAC as it premieres the latest body of work by internationally renowned photographer Edward Bertinsky. And joining me in the studio to talk about it all is Lindsay Ross with the Contemporary Arts Center and NOMA's curator of photographs, Russell Lord. Welcome to Inside the Arts.
Thank you.
Thank you, Diane.
Art for Art's Sake. This is the annual rite of fall that many look forward to in the Arts District. Lindsay, what is on tap this year?
Well, this is an event that the Contemporary Arts Center created in 1980. Over the years, we've grown, and there are citywide galleries participating from Uptown to the Marigny and beyond. But the focus really is around the Arts District. We have a Julia Street block party from 6 to 9 p.m., and all the galleries on Julia Street are open. We have two site-specific art installations by local artists, and those are interactive. We try to do that each year. We call that Artmosphere, so you can come check out a sort of one-night-only happening, and we'll have a DJ. And then we encourage everyone to make time to head over to the Contemporary Arts Center for our exhibition reception, also 6 to 9, to see the new show, Water.
Russell, tell me about Water and the photographer, the internationally acclaimed Edward Bertinsky.
Edward Bertinsky is a Canadian photographer and artist, really, based in Toronto. He has been working for about 30 years in the field and has produced a number of books and a number of exhibitions that have traveled around the world, including the China Oil and a series on rock quarries. He really is an interesting figure because he hovers between the worlds of fine art and kind of classic photography. His pictures are in many ways documentary images, but especially with this new body of work, they border on the edge of complete abstraction. So many contemporary art dealers have really responded to these pictures. And I think that they, in the end, kind of hover between the worlds of painting and photography.
Now, I understand that the pictures were taken all over the world, and New Orleans has a big presence.
That's correct. This survey, which is 5 years in the making, includes pictures from China, India, Europe, Iceland, Canada, and British Columbia, and all throughout the United States. But what is particularly important for this community is that the exhibition and the book that accompanies it, they begin with pictures of the Gulf of Mexico in the aftermath of the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. So it places New Orleans and the Gulf region at the center of this very global story about water's increasingly fragmented life cycle.
The photographs are large scale. Can you talk about that and describe maybe a few of the pictures we'll see?
They are massive. They begin at 48 by 60 inches and go up from there. A few of them are over 10 feet in length. They're all color images, and most of them, almost all of them, were made from an aerial perspective. Bertinsky has traveled around the world and worked with helicopter pilots, plane pilots. He has a pneumatic pole that extends over 50 feet into the air. In some cases, he even made a few photographs with a drone helicopter where he mounted his camera to the drone. So he's really gone above and beyond just to achieve the picture that he wants to make of each particular place. As I said, many of the pictures really border on the edge of complete abstraction. So in many ways, we as viewers have to work really hard to decipher these images as photographs. So many people look at them and think that they are drawings or paintings upon first glance.
The photographs are also quite seductive in their beauty. And we find out that it's something quite different that we're looking at.
Yes, it's true. I think that Edward Bertinsky has certainly a specific story in mind behind these pictures, and he's very ecologically minded. So in many cases, these pictures, which are really beautiful, turn out to be of places where we have shaped the surface of the Earth in a very negative way, where there is a kind of imbalance. There's a section on distressed landscapes where there are kind of gouged and scraped riverbeds where we've completely drained the rivers to divert the water to a certain community. So it really addresses how our relationship with water has changed, especially over the past 100 years, and what humans have done to really kind of either attempt to direct or control water as a resource, and what potentially that might mean for our future. So the exhibition really functions as a kind of open-ended question about the past, present, and future of humanity's relationship with this resource. I hope that people will walk away with a kind of better understanding of the global scale of this problem and what potentially our role might be. I also think that the exhibition is not incredibly didactic. Depending on what you bring to the exhibition, you might feel a totally different way about these pictures. It's worth noting that with the oil series, many people looked at those pictures and said, oh, well, this is really terrible what we're doing to the Earth. We're really kind of digging in and farming it. And then there were other people in the oil industry who looked at those pictures as records of their achievement. They, you know, thought that they were these incredible icons of what they had built. And there is certainly a kind of bit about human ingenuity in this exhibition. The massive dams, the incredibly maze-like stepwells in India that he's documented, they really do kind of show the lengths that we've gone to farm or direct or control water as a resource.
Yes. And Lindsay, in addition to the photographic exhibit by Edward Bertinsky, Water, there are even more openings at the CAC.
There are from 6 to 9. You can also check out Submerge, which is a solo show by local artist Lee Dygard. The Visual Arts Network organizes an installation each year for their national meeting, which this year takes place in New Orleans. So we'll be showing their annual exhibition. And we have a sound installation by Brendan Connolly.
Lindsay and Russell, thanks for stopping by.
Thank you.
We were talking with Lindsay Ross of the Contemporary Art Center and Russell Lord with the New Orleans Museum of Art. Art for Art's Sake kicks off Saturday from 6 to 9 p.m. with free art openings citywide, including galleries and businesses on Julia Street, Magazine Street, and the French Quarter. More info at cacno.org.
If it keeps on raining, the levee's gonna break. If it keeps on raining, the levee's gonna break.
You're listening to Inside the Arts on 89.9 WWNO, New Orleans Public Radio. I'm Diane Mack. New Orleans is the focus of the North American premiere of Scottish Ballet's A Streetcar Named Desire. This adaptation of playwright Tennessee Williams' Pulitzer Prize-winning masterpiece blends drama, dance, and jazz. Christopher Hampson is Scottish Ballet's artistic director. Welcome to Inside the Arts.
Thanks very much.
This is a classic story close to the hearts of New Orleanians, as our city is center stage. It's been adapted for film, for television, opera, and two ballets. Tell me, how did you come to choose it for your North American premiere in New Orleans?
Well, as you say, it's a wonderful story and so central to New Orleans as a backdrop to the story. The production that we're bringing really highlights the inner emotions of these four main characters. And I think the wonderful part about presenting it in movement and in dance is you can get really into the nooks and crannies of those emotions that can't be put into words. And I think that's something that brings a new element to the story. I think particularly the fact that Scottish Ballet paired Annabelle Lopez Ochoa, a choreographer, with a theatre director, Nancy Meckler, has really added to the way we're able to communicate this in a dance production in quite a different way to normal dance productions.
How do you tell the story of Blanche DuBois, a fading Southern belle, her sister Stella, and husband Stanley Kowalski, who thinks Blanche is holding out on inheritance money? How do you bring that to dance?
The actual story of Blanche, because a lot of her neurosis and fear and the pressure she puts on herself and others around her is so palpable and affects all the other characters. And our principal dancer that plays this role, Eve Mutzo, has brilliantly inhabited this character. I think she does an excellent job. The relationship between Stella, between Stanley, is ever-changing. And I think the choreography actually allows us to explore those inner emotions, the way somebody glances at someone, the way they might grab hold of them, and explore those even further without text. So I guess for such a text-heavy story, one concern may be that it doesn't have the meat, if you like, to hang on the bones. But that's certainly not the case with this.
Wow. This is quite a large production. How many dancers are involved?
Well, it's nearly 30 dancers are involved in the production. We're actually a company of 36 dancers, but it is a brilliantly constructed work. The central characters remain constant throughout the production. However, the rest of the dancers become, if you like in Greek drama, like a chorus, and they morph into whichever environment they need to be able to frame the central story.
What were the challenges for you in bringing this to stage?
Well, I know that the dancers worked very hard, but of course, once you're in the studio, it can get to a place where when you bring it to the stage, suddenly all the parameters change. The set design is absolutely integral to the performance. And so once we got to the stage, that was a whole new geography for the dancers. I think that was one of the biggest challenges. But I think also the intensity of doing a brand new work to a commissioned score, which is brilliantly composed by Peter Salem, that's also an unknown. So once the dancers get to the stage, hearing the music for the first time and being in this new environment which they've got to work is quite a challenge, but something they're brilliant at. So, you know, I've got no worries.
And speaking of music, this is done to a jazz score?
Yes, it's quite an eclectic mix of music. Peter has his own phonic world, if you like, that is, you know, is wonderful and brings a sense of atmosphere to the work. But he references quite well-known works as well. There's Paper Moon is a theme, and that song Paper Moon runs through the score as well. And there are other little quotes in there. So it's, I think, as an audience, you are sitting in a world that feels familiar.
Yes. Tell us about Scottish Ballet. This is Scotland's national dance company.
Yes, that's right. And we have a remit, as we're funded by government here in Scotland, to perform nationally within Scotland and within the United Kingdom. But also, we think of ourselves as cultural ambassadors for Scotland. So these opportunities to go offshore and to be touring our own work that we've created, is a real highlight to all the other works that we do. Obviously, bringing something like a title of A Streetcar Named Desire to New Orleans is absolutely fantastic for the company. It's a great profile for us. And I'm excited very much for the dancers to be in New Orleans. I've visited a few years ago, and I absolutely love the place.
What are you hoping audiences will remember most from this experience in New Orleans?
I think they'll see an incredibly engaging and dramatic performance. I hope that they also enjoy the range that these dancers are able to deliver. It's such high-intensity drama, but the physicality is just as important too. So I hope they see these really beautiful, refined dancers.
Beautiful. I hope you enjoy your trip to New Orleans.
I'm sure I will. I look forward to it.
Christopher Hampson, Artistic Director of Scottish Ballet. The New Orleans Ballet Association opens its 2013-14 season with the North American premiere of Scottish Ballet's A Streetcar Named Desire. A full evening ballet at the Mahalia Jackson Theater, Friday, October 4th at 8 p.m. Looking now towards the upcoming New Orleans Film Festival, Take Five's Brian Friedman talks to actors David Jensen and Joe Crest about their entry, The King of Herrings. These are two out of five men that met back when they attended LSU, but never had the chance to collaborate. Friedman finds out what it was like to finally make a film together after 25 years.
Anita's Grill sits on Tulane Avenue, directly across from a massive construction site. While it once served up liver and onions, pork chops, and their signature pancakes 24 hours a day, construction on the LSU and VA hospitals led Anita's to a temporary 6 a.m. to 2 p.m. schedule. But those abbreviated hours offered a different type of opportunity. It allowed Anita's to be one of the main sets for The King of Herrings, a selection in this year's New Orleans Film Fest. We sat down in a booth at Anita's with actors David Jensen and Joe Crest after closing time, the same time the crew came and shot many scenes of the film.
It has to do with a socioeconomic class that no one else talks about.
That's Jensen, who plays Gat, one of the movie's four main characters, whose daily struggles for respect, affection, a few bucks, and a cheap thrill generate the bulk of the film's story.
They hang out here in Anita's. They drink coffee. They're not family guys.
And they, you know, fantasize about and actually try to screw each other's wives. But they would put it a different way.
That's Crest, who plays the professor, a scholarly magazine salesman who tries to find unique ways to mix his business with pleasure.
It's like the only thing they have is their machismo. You know, they don't have the means to do anything really except have coffee and talk and dream.
Like in this scene, where Gat has coffee at Anita's with a combustible ditch, played by the movie's writer and director, Eddie Jemison, and laments a recent encounter with a certain redhead.
Look, I am what I am. That's that.
I wear these clothes. I like rum and cokes. I mean, that's...
What?
Me? A big horse, some money, a girl looks at me, I'm off. A wife. The apartment, I'm in some car headed west.
Yeah,
let her hair catch the wind. I'm not even looking in the rearview mirror.
Oh, you don't even have a car.
Jemison is a veteran actor of film and television, including the role of tech-savvy Livingston Dell in Ocean's 11 through 13. He met Crest and Jensen, as well as John Meese, who plays Augie in the film, 25 years ago at LSU's MFA acting program, studying under their mentor, the late theater professor John Dennis. Wayne Perret plays the throat cancer surviving Leon, who speaks through an electrolarynx, which sounds like this.
I'm getting fat.
No, you look good. You look slender.
Should we leave?
He befriended the crew as an LSU undergrad, and while the five pursued their acting careers in Los Angeles, New York, Chicago, and New Orleans, collectively racking up hundreds of different roles.
John has been the glue that are the point of which, you know, we all still connect.
Jemison had originally written Herrings as a play that he wanted Dennis to direct. Unfortunately, Dennis's poor health forced him to reluctantly back out of the project.
As he became more fragile, you know, I said to Eddie, I said, well, what do you think about shooting it as a movie?
Crest was on board.
We never would have come together if not for him. You know, I mean, we did it for him, and he got us all together. And because we were there, it's like, well, you know, we bought the tickets, we're here, you know, I mean, let's do this.
While The King of Herrings is set in New Orleans, it doesn't feel the need to constantly remind the viewer that they're in the Big Easy.
We shot in here, and, you know, there might be a little saint stuff in the vague background, but, you know, we're not peeling crawfish and drinking a beer.
And I'm so proud of it, yeah. There's no gumbo in your face or anything like that.
Still, the experience of filming in the Crescent City proved to be a moving experience, particularly for Jensen.
When you grow up in New Orleans and you feel like wherever you are in the city is home, when you've ridden your bicycle on every street, it's a different comfort level, you know, when to know everywhere you're going to be on the call sheet. We're going to be at Children's Hospital on Henry Clay, you know, or we're going to be wherever, Michoud. It's great.
Down the road, the guys will be taking The King of Herrings back to its roots, performing it as a play in Los Angeles. They're also looking forward to filming Jemison's next screenplay, The Affair, which centers on the BP oil spill. So look out for the King of Herrings. And if you get to Anita's, they say the pancakes are their pride and joy. For WWNO, I'm Brian Friedman.
The 24th Annual New Orleans Film Fest will take place October 10th through 17th. For a complete listing of showtimes and events, visit NewOrleansFilmSociety.org. Brian Friedman's coverage of Hollywood South is brought to you in partnership with NOLA V and is made possible with the assistance of the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation. And we have something extra in our Lanyap Corner. One of jazz music's top innovators, trumpeter and composer Christian Scott, will perform with his quintet at Snug Harbor, 626 Frenchman Street, Friday, October 4th. Two sets, 8 and 10 p.m. The Big Easy Roller Girls will host their 8th annual league tryouts as they recruit new skaters Thursday, October 3rd at 6 p.m. at Skate Country West Bank. Only women ages 19 and older are eligible to try out for the local roller derby team. More info on the league at BigEasyRollerGirls.com. And Art Home New Orleans kicks off its 4th annual tour, opening the doors to creative spaces in the Central Business District. The self-guided public tour is presented by the Creative Alliance of New Orleans. Participants will explore the Old American sector by visiting studios of artists and producers, art-filled offices, and private residences. October 5th and 6th, from noon until 5. The tour begins at the Contemporary Arts Center, 900 Camp Street. More info at cano-la.org. That's our show for this week. Inside the Arts is a production of WWNO. Our program is archived at WWNO.org. I'll be back with more ideas for your artistic palette next Tuesday at 1 p.m. when we'll go Inside the Arts. I'm Diane Mack.